if you look at the foundational video that they made about TPUSA, there's a crying wealthy man who is in like an opulent office full of like severed animal heads and shit, and he's crying about the idea.
How have I never seen this?
That maybe Charlie Kirk will make the kids be nice to me, that he suffered through so much.
Welcome to Doomscroll. I'm your host, Joshua Citarella. My guest is Julian Field, an author, journalist, co-founder of the QAA podcast, and the host of Superstructure. So I wanted to talk about calculating influence on media. Like, when does someone say something that has an impact in the real world? Like, when does rhetoric move from just being, you know, fluff that we put up into the internet into moving materials in the real world, influencing how people vote, protest, if they organize in their workplace, stuff like this? How do you even approach that question?
I tend to kind of try to sever that connection a little bit for people and show them that both the speech and the structures of, you know, physical violence or exclusion, you know, from, I don't know, banking or just basic things, right? Like basic things that you need to live. Once you start having people target you and take that away from you, or once they take away your freedom and put you in jail, or they take away your life, or they maim you or affect you in some way, that's where you can really see the structure. So speech comes from the same situations and world than that does. And so the idea of like, well, if we let speech happen for long enough, it trickles into violence, I think misunderstands the causational relationship here. I think that the situation that is causing both the speech and something, you know, more grave,
Okay.
You know what I mean? That's the causation, right? Instead of this idea of like, well, if we let them talk enough, that's going to trickle down into violence. If you change the conditions, people will talk differently. They will. Things change.
Sounds like you're describing a distinction between the base and superstructure, my friend.
A little bit.
Which would happen to be the name of your new show?
It is, yeah.
Can you give us a quick plug for what I'm referencing here?
Yeah, Superstructure, my new show. I think that one thing that happened over the 7 years of studying conspiracy theories and, you know, strange online communities, and the way that, like, very realistically, this kind of thought bomb that was QAnon trickled into politics, and now politicians will either act or say things that before would never have been countenanced. What happened over time of studying exactly what you were describing is that I started caring less and less about it. I found it less and less relevant. I was like, does this really matter? Are we really talking about a structure of power here? Or are we talking about, you know, oh, well, the new big streamer is like this. What does that say about us? And the conclusion, or the facile conclusion, I hope that my work with QAA hasn't been like that, but the facile conclusion is, well, isn't that worrying? Isn't that worrying? It's very worrying that people are talking like this now, you know, as if somehow their words, if let, you know, run on long enough, are going to magically transform themselves into structures of power. Instead of the way that I see it, these are lumped proletariat often, you know, even if they do get like
You mean like the lone wolf crazy people?
No, I'm talking about those kick streamers. I'm talking about almost anybody that we currently discuss and go, you know, the manosphere people and stuff like that. I think that if it wasn't them, it would be somebody else. And the fact that it's in our schools and the fact that kids are consuming this stuff means that on some level, it's the logical next progression, I suppose, for, like you said, the market forces. So superstructure is an attempt to vulgarize and bring to the average person an understanding of history and an understanding of something a little bit more tangible, I suppose. You know, how does repression really happen? Who puts out propaganda? Where does that money come from? Propaganda is one of the more interesting ones because it's created by the structure that wants to reinforce its own tangible foothold, right? So there you're dealing with words that matter a little bit more because they are literally the words of the oppressor, right? They are the words of the person who is powerful that is being distributed with the power of money behind it. So superstructure, I think, is an attempt for me. And obviously, I'm still going to be on QAA. I love the podcast. I love that project. But I needed something that would feel a little meatier for me and a little more meaningful.
So allow me to reiterate some of this. And then I have a question that I'll segue us into. So I think, and I'm quite sympathetic to this reading myself, but your analysis would be something like the base, the material base of society is eroding. We have a downwardly mobile middle class. On top of that, we have this media ecosystem. And so if you look at the asymmetry of wealth in American society, you can predictably find a way in which crazy people go out and do, you know, antisocial behavior. And then also you have like the media angle to it, but it's not like the media is acting upon the people and shaping their, you know, consciousness raising, as we might describe it from the Marxist left. We are, however, engaged in, I think you could call it propaganda, consciousness raising, all of this stuff. Like, what is the utility of giving people this history? You're doing something of an educational program. So what is it that you optimistically hope to achieve through that?
I optimistically hope to educate myself.
Yourself?
Yeah, okay. To be honest, you know. The way that superstructure works is we have a huge team of deep researchers who are going to read several books on a topic. Mm. They're going to be specialists in that field, and they're going to draw up something that I'm going to have to study first so I can teach it to John. Not even teach it, just pass it on. I think that in so many cases and so many, especially now that, you know, everything is a psyop, everything is marketing, even when you hear the way that people talk about writing books or making art, it's just like, what is the effect? What do I want my reader to feel in this scene? Mm-hmm. That is profoundly manipulative. You know, when I write or I create a podcast, my goal is to give you as many of the elements so that you can give yourself or draw yourself a picture of what is happening. An understanding of what is happening. It's not to transmit something that if I manage to worm into your brain, you're going to be a better person. You know, my favorite things to consume treat me like somebody who doesn't need to be condescended to, who doesn't need to be convinced of a specific point. And that's not to say that opinions won't be in there. My opinion is fine. I just don't think it matters all that much. So I think that like creating a refined process for people to receive history or current events or political theory, I see myself, I guess, more as a conduit, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, my project is not like some sort of ideological project. I guess naively believe that if you gave people enough information, they would come to their own conclusions. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, in one of our first episodes, I define the bourgeoisie, the petty bourgeoisie, and the proletariat, not because I'm going to frame my whole podcast around that, not because I'm going to use those words over and over, but because they're going to come up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the way I think of it, you know? And that's not to say that I'm post-ideological. I have very strong opinions of my own. I just don't believe that me furiously expounding on those opinions is going to... It's not interesting to me, to be honest.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I have a similar impulse where... I have a deep faith in the ability of regular people to make up their own mind. That I think that is, you know, core or integral to a democratic society. And you mentioned serving as a conduit before. I'm going to try and roll a few things together here. But at the very beginnings of this project, we're going back like 8 years now or something like that. We started talking about funnels and pipelines and like how to utilize media rather than just espousing editorial opinion, but where is your audience coming from? Where do you want them to go to? So,
see, I really don't think that way.
Mm.
You know, I
think we need to start thinking this way.
I understand. I mean, I understand that people believe that. I guess I just, I don't connect, or at least I would say I'm not interested in trying to manipulate my audience.
Well, manipulation would be
where are you coming from? Where are you going? I don't care. I really don't care. I don't think I can affect that much. But I'm sorry. I interrupted you. I didn't even let you finish my point. This is one of the things I do.
So try to think of how best to phrase this. Our political opponents are thinking this way. And they're thinking this way to great success, where they are now institutionally organized. They have their own parapolitical organizations, pseudo-institutions.
Sure.
Some of them are now in the halls of government. Some of them are in the White House. And that's because they considered this process intentionally trying to upstream the funnels and pipelines that we laid out theoretically many years ago. So I think we could, you know, disingenuously describe it as marketing or the persuasion, or you're like duping people into thinking a certain way. But you can provide them with information from which they can rationally deliberate and make up their own minds.
But it still won't make a difference. See, even if they change their mind, it does not matter to me. If you think that you're fighting the power and you live in the United States and you're American, I'm sorry to tell you, your battle's already been lost, you know?
Are you just an absolute political nihilist then?
No, I'm not a nihilist.
Do you want your listeners to vote, protest, organize in their workplace? Like,
what
do they
do
once they have this information?
I have no opinion and I wouldn't pretend to know.
Are you doing plausible deniability for somebody in your audience? Like,
no, absolutely. Go do your thing.
To watch part two of this episode, you can support the show on Patreon. What do you expect people to do once they have this information from listening to your show?
I would not pretend to know, I genuinely have no idea. And I also think if you're looking at this as a kind of generational battle for, I guess, the political leanings of a country.
I am.
That's awesome, man. I think the United States is the great Satan and I've long given up on it, you know? I think that it's going to continue on its course. I mean,
in the most conventional sense, though, from like the Leninist party newspaper, right? The purpose of publishing is, one, it binds the party together because they're engaged in this productive activity as their source of income. You needed at that time, you know, like a dozen people to run the machine and to hand them out. Like, it's an activity you do together. Secondary to that was consciousness raising so that the proletariat would be aware of the economic relationship that they have to the means of production. And from that newly raised consciousness, they would then decide to organize. They could realize where their political power was located. Is that not a fair? I mean, I think that is like expressly the purpose of what we're doing by commenting in this space.
It is a fair assessment. I would just say, like, if you really want to fight that battle, move to Cuba, move to Venezuela. Move to Iran, like go anywhere where there's a tangible resistance to this empire, because making content is not going to change a damn thing at the end of the day. And that's from somebody who does it professionally, you know, and I really hope that people will remember an episode or something that they learned when they make their decisions. But to think of myself as some sort of architect of the destiny of the United States of America, I mean, absolutely, forget it. Forget it. Like, I don't think of myself that way, which might explain why I'm depressed a lot of the time.
Julian.
Yeah, I'm not super happy, you know? I think we live in a part of history that's somewhat overdetermined, you know? Especially if you're in the United States. I mean, What a great feeling to make content behind the shield of the great Satan, right? To just sit in these chairs and go get a coffee and go and have a little debate in America, you know? I'm insulting myself at the same time. I mean, I'm doing the same thing, but it's somewhat irrelevant, you know? I think that anybody who's going to kind of listen to a debate on political theory is already somebody that is not part of the people that will truly make a difference when the time comes.
Let's approach this from the other side then.
Sure.
What would you say about what was the impact of the enormous, like, Q lore, for example? Like, because that is, you know, we're talking about this very narrow content layer in which we express editorial opinions. Did that enormous amount of like conspiracy type stuff later affect the movement of materials in the world?
It's a good question. I think it did, but the way that I see it is the thing it affected was a peach, and the thing that affected it was a moving line of rot. You know, and so you could say like, well, look, I just spotted the first blue spot on this peach. And then later there was more of it. It was consuming the peach. The peach is now entirely rotten. Does that mean that you can draw like a nice clean causational line between that first spot of mold and the rotting?
I don't
think so. Because the whole process is part of a larger thing, right? Like, the peach was always going to rot. And I think that QAnon, first of all, there's almost nothing new in it. It's really just like a kind of resubscribing to like ancient, you know, American conspiracy
beliefs. Literally
from
the Middle Ages in some cases.
Well, it's all just a mix of anti-communism. It's a mix of satanic panic and like Christian extremism. You know, there's there are tangible movements that have created a lot of these belief systems, and then people espouse them because they were there at the right time, you know? So, you know, if somebody watches a Joshua Citarella sit down and then they go and act on something or go do something, and you could go, well, the last thing they watched was Joshua Citarella. And it's like, that's, you know, that's really interesting. It's like saying, like, the peach was last in this plastic bag. Doesn't tell us much.
I was saying a similar thing in 24, where there was like all of this talk about like, Trump appeared on these different podcasts and that like swayed people's votes and whatever. And I think that that was very specifically, very narrowly framed to kind of isolate a much longer process, right? So I've been doing this work for, I don't know how many years, but like there were young men who were like 14 or 15 years old in this mimetic ecosystem, and they would go through high school. Some of them would go to higher education. Some of them would go directly into the workforce. Some of them would go to the National Guard, like all sorts of different outcomes. And I thought to myself, like, well, what is the downstream impact that I could hope to have on this? And I thought that maybe the best example is that from the time when they're 15 and they encounter some messaging, it plants a seed that when they're 25, proletarianized in the workforce, peeing in that bucket in Amazon, they think to themselves, you know, I did hear about unions at some point, and that gives them permission to kind of, you know, understand where their political power comes from.
Sure.
And so those kind of like, you know, decade long, this is literally what I mean, like talking about a generational arc for the hearts and minds of the American public. I do take those things quite seriously. Are you foreclosing, like, I'm still optimistic for democratic reforms to kind of change the course of this ship?
No, definitely not. No, the United States is so far beyond democratic reform and has been for decades. And I'm talking about the structure itself, right? Like the military, the bases, even the kind of political class is interchangeable. If you take Trump out and get another guy in there, it doesn't make a difference.
The blob?
Yeah.
The deep blob, state?
The blob lives on, and like it has zero to do with the consciousness of the people.
So you're not seeing him as like a tide shift of anything significant?
Not at all. Absolutely not. Once again, just a nice bloom in the rot, you know?
Would you similarly say that some parts of the like retreat from globalization were like they were already percolating under Biden, and Trump is kind of carrying out that, what did you describe it as before, like the same trend line?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, of course. You know,
but doing it in a like kind of bizarre, ridiculous way.
Sure. I mean, we're just realizing that the promises of neoliberalism are not going to be kept, you know? And so everyone realizes that.
Rats.
You know, at their own rhythm. And they feel rightfully lied to. And they were lied to by Biden. They were lied to by Trump. But going back to Trump after Biden, I think is really, it really shows how deeply we'd like something different. And even to the point of like, if we can just inject a chaos agent into this mess, then I can at least express my anger at being lied to. And the other party never apologized for neoliberalism, right? You don't have the Democrats
The Democrats.
Yeah, you don't have them going up there and saying, hey, what we promised you in the 90s, that was bullshit.
Yeah, David Frum is doing it more than the Democrats.
And that's what I'm saying is like, if you don't get up there and say, hey, we lied to you. We supported genocide. We're colluding with the same companies or like maybe like a different sector of the economy of companies than the Republicans. If you don't come clean, we're not getting anywhere. You know, I mean, we all are living in the great disappointment of a massive lie about something that to the world is very irrelevant, right? Because it's like, if we get our treats or if our economy allows us to buy houses or any of this, it won't change the fact that we have our boot, like as a country, like our taxes all get funneled up to create a boot that is on so many different necks for this to even happen. What we're seeing right now is the bourgeoisie being so greedy that they are willing to create the same conditions in their own country, in their own voting blocks, that they've been creating abroad for a long, long time. A long, long time. And that is terminal.
A few months ago, we started putting our episodes onto Spotify. If you're subscribed on Spotify Premium, you can watch our videos ad-free. The best way to support the show is on Patreon or Substack. We do a bonus episode with every guest. Follow us on Spotify, Patreon, Substack, maybe something else in the future. Let's get back to the episode.
But you were talking specifically about action movies and action boys, and like there's something there, because one of the things that we're trying to cover on Superstructure is a whole generation of like propagandistic action films.
Sure.
Some of them on purpose and some of them not so much. Some of them just because they got pickled in the same brine mm-hmm. as the rest of mm-hmm. us. So I do like that. I like that vector of
what's like a classic example for people who don't know?
Commando is perfect. I mean, any movie in which like a hyper effective kind of operator is sent to foreign country, you know, insert foreign country to get something done is perfect. I mean, it's deliciously propagandistic. Despite
like Rambo movies, maybe.
Sure, that... Rambo. I mean, certainly number two.
I haven't seen that in like 20 years, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it's all just us kind of sublimating things that we become aware of, like the war on Central American, you know, resistance struggles, the mm-hmm. war on South American resistance struggles, the Middle East, Cuba, you know, whatever the evil guy of the day is, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm. I can't avoid this. Some of those movies have been effective at propagandizing the public to produce their consent for the activities of American empire. And that was an effective utilization of media. I want to ask this question, though, about if we are mobilizing a hyper-vigilant revolutionary vanguard, rather than getting the, you know, majoritarian democratic society to collectively decide to produce change, is there some point at which the normies jump off? That they can go so far, but they get uncomfortable with certain topics.
Normie being what? An American audience member?
Well, we've been talking about this thing on the show of like, how many people can you really convince? And there's kind of a lot of questions underneath that, which is like, in a democratic society, which is, you know, very difficult to have revolution in an advanced industrial economy or post-industrial economy mm-hmm. in a democratic society, because there's all of these different avenues to basically take certain parts of this platform, deliver part of it, and you just diffuse this coalition. So are we strategically looking to mobilize 60% of the population to democratically agree? Or are we looking to mobilize a very dedicated 20% of people that will, you know, cause some kind of revolutionary activity, probably lower than 20%, like 10%?
Quite frankly, have no idea, you know? That's such a difficult one. I also don't believe that those two things are like totally mutually exclusive. I think that this is a very big, like, you know, me going out on a limb to like kind of hypothetically, because it's really not my approach. Mm-hmm. I'm not here to like convince people or mobilize them in any way. But I would say it's probably, if it's ever going to happen, it's going to happen a little bit further down the line. There mm-hmm. has to be a bit of a decay even further, unfortunately, even though we're already in a very painful moment. I think that it's going to get worse. And I really don't know. It is a very good question. It is a very good question because, you know, it's this idea of like, oh, can we just do it with like, you know, a couple of divisions and a petty bourgeois brain like slapped mm-hmm. onto it? Or do we need to effect like electoral sea change? I very frankly don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry if that's disappointing. Mostly because I don't see myself as someone who's really able to affect that. Like, I think that it's, this country's on a path of its own. But if you were talking to me about other countries, it's way more interesting because the effect of organizing and the effect of spreading media is so much more tangible, right? Like,
okay.
Because I think what we're in currently is just a big dissociative dream mm-hmm. here, right?
And are you, other countries, are you thinking like Cuba or Europe? Like
anywhere except Western Europe and the United States.
Okay. Anywhere outside of the Western Bloc.
Well, anyone who isn't like this essentially like neo-colonial violent military power that believes that it can violate the sovereignty of any country it wishes based on its own whims. Mm. So if you step outside of that, you have some resistance. what the population thinks in a country like this, I think what's been proven is that it doesn't fucking matter. They're going to do whatever they want anyways. I don't think there's a lot of people who would say that Congress and the Senate are effective and useful bodies, not to say that we should eliminate them, but do they really have access to any levers of power if they can't stop a war of aggression on Iran? And that's changed pretty dramatically, or at least the illusion has changed, right? I think that there was a period of time in American history where, or European history, where we thought we could change this. But at the end of the day, it literally doesn't matter if there's a plurality that believes one thing. This structure of power and these people that are at the top and that can really affect change, that can order a killing or throw the weight of money behind them, they really don't give a shit what we think. So while we sit here and talk about mobilization and this and that and the other, the question is, how much can you do from behind the gun?
Mm.
And the answer to me is not that much, because the gun's also pointed at you. They've created the Omni gun.
Mm.
So that even if you're kind of complicit, your tax money is going towards like forming that boot on the neck of a foreign country or somebody, even someone here domestically that's disempowered, there's a gun pointed to you as well. And it says, hey, we have a militarized police now. If you say something wrong, we can come and knock down your door.
What would you say to the Republicans, this is in the news this week, gerrymandering all of these districts to, you know, ensure that red states stay forever red and that blue states erode towards being increasingly more red?
Makes sense to me. I mean, I guess they're just getting tired with the whole pendulum. Like, it was a fun game to play for a while, but they get bored when they're four years out of the executive, especially now that they've strengthened the executive to the point where it can basically, like, order murders at whim and start wars at whim. I think it just shows that the Republican Party at this point is almost like suicidally vying for power. They do not care about the democratic process at all. Not even the surface nod that we used to at least get, you know, like in a Reagan speech or something like that. You at least had to nod to that. But at this point, no, I don't think they're just trying to shove Democrats out. I think they're also cannibalizing themselves, you know? Not to mention the fact that I think that both parties are just an extension of capital at the end of the day. So, you know, kind of pick your factions of capital and pick your approach to masking the crime, right? Is it going to be, looking good and proper and saying the right words and being respectable? That's the Democrats' choice. I think it's a little out of fashion at this point, you know, because so many people watch them go through that charade and just think, fuck you.
Hmm.
So then the first guy who steps up and goes, fuck them, it's like, well, at least he said that. And I think that's Donald Trump for us.
Are labor unions that still have this vestigial attachment to the Democratic Party, are they complicit in capital in the same way?
Wow. I mean, I'd point the finger at everybody else before them. My quick answer is no. You know.
So I agree. But should that not be a vector from which to like rebuild if there is this, you know, real undeniable confrontation with capital that is organized labor, and that thing is attached to the democratic process? Like, should that not be the primary place from which you build?
Is it attached to the democratic process, or is it a democratic process in and of itself that tries to defend workers' rights? That's what I would say, is like, I'm way more interested in the democracy inside of a union than the democracy that they're somehow attached to by endorsing candidates, or what exactly would you lay at the feet of the unions?
Yeah, endorsements, the kind of political machine of turning people out to vote, where, you know, in like, let's roll back the clock a few decades, that there's a lot of media to sift through about whether you support column A or column B of certain candidates in a primary. Mm-hmm. The union would say, okay, go for this person. This is why it was such a big deal when it was the rank and file would go for Bernie and then the leadership would go for Warren, this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then also their ability to bankroll candidates. They were bigger, much more significant player economically in terms of funding. The last thing I want to ask you on this topic is, we can put this behind the paywall if you choose, what are your thoughts on the DSA?
Do it. Fellas, you're doing great. I'm behind you. okay. I don't know. I feel like it's a great thing. You know, it's going to exist. If more and more people change their mind and start seeing things somewhat clearly, they're going to look outside of the two-party apparatus, I mm-hmm. think, for answers. And I support anything that attempts that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Someone's trying something, like, you know, at least, like, they're doing, you know, mutual aid on a local level. Like, I think a lot of that organizing is really good. And I think that a lot of the discourse around it is exhausting and useless.
It can be. It can be very annoying, but it can also be necessary.
Yeah, well, guess what? Like, no matter what side of the coin you're going to be on, there's a good chance you're annoying. Like, most people are fucking annoying. You know, it's like if I let, like, the fact that DSA is annoying or members, I don't know, dress or talk a certain way and get in the way of, like, me thinking DSA is a good thing. It's the same argument as, like, oh, well, unions are corrupt, too. Mm. It's like, well, okay, fine. Let's say unions are as corrupt as the corporate structure. Don't you think that the outcome for labor is still better when there's two powerful structures dialoguing to get somewhere instead of just one dictating the terms in an ever worsening condition?
Yeah, totally, totally.
So, hey,
okay.
All my support.
My last autistic rant on this, I promise, and then I'll move on to other topics.
I would never accuse you of being
autistic. We are in... Thank you so much. We're in a unique media environment in which the audiences for some of these newsletters, podcasts, publications of all sorts are now quantitatively larger than the proper political organizations. And they are monetized in such a way where to be a subscriber for a podcast is generates more revenue than the dues-paying memberships for the organizations. It gets weirder where the party newsletter, which all of these groups have, runs on the same publishing infrastructure as the media entities. There is a kind of singularity emerging of this, like, political, media, para-institutional, who knows what to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've seen people on the right begin to form these pseudo-organizations that now have more fundraising capacity, more productive calls to action in terms of mobilizing their following to show up to a protest or to vote or whatever. And so these things are structurally resembling each other more and more. If you wanted to get the furthest upstream of those things, this is, I think, the purpose of this show, is to kind of, like, bring in this structural media analysis for us to start thinking about what we're doing. Because if you're watching Twitch streamers turn out more people to door knock and canvas versus the literal Democratic Party, this is kind of a big game changer. Like, I think we really need to think of how to utilize these tools, and we may be very abruptly much more powerful than we had assumed before. I think Kassan is doing a lot of this now where he's like, basically, it seems, as much as I can keep up with this stuff, he is just going to every kind of socialist niche candidate in every district, seemingly all around the country, helping them fundraise, helping get people out. And we'll see in a few months, or maybe like a month from now, what impact that has.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think we have to start thinking about these things seriously to give, I'm gonna, mentioned autism before, I'm gonna stat dump at you now. So the height of the Socialist Party of America in 1912, I believe, is 113,000 members. Currently, the DSA is 95,000 members. The population of the United States back in 1912 was around 95,000. These are rough, and now it's like 330 or whatever. So you would need to multiply the DSA about three times over, roughly, right? So if you had 330,000 members, what that would do to the organization was it would force a whole bunch of normal people who are not like middle-class graphic designers who want to, you know, feel good about their politics into this socialist organization. Downstream of those things, if you look at, okay, what's the lever? What's like the real lever that then radically transforms society within a half generation? SAP, 113,000 members, 11% union density within 15 years after that, the United States goes to an all-time high of 33% union density. I am trying to set up the preconditions for us to realize that again, the height of American labor power. I think that those things are possible because we have accidentally, unbeknownst to ourselves, just fallen backwards into a strawberry patch where we now have the largest media apparatus available, and we have to learn how to actually pull the levers that we do not yet know are attached to it. I think that is possible. We have examples of, I wanted to ask you about AOC is now polling in the top spot for leader for presidential candidates for 2028. Surprising, but when she was playing Among Us with Hassan Piker, they just broke through all of these crazy records for fundraising for the charity stream. Yeah. I mean, this is like 4 or 5 years ago now. There's all of these examples that we can cite about how we can turn people out and actually demonstrate political power.
Doesn't that mean, though, to me, what I see when I hear that is just that we're so busy just consuming content that it's almost like giving a dog a pill like wrapped in like peanut butter or something. We now need it to be flavored that way, right? Like we're
flavored which way?
Like a stream, like Hassan's stream or your interview show or my podcast. People increasingly, the best they can do is consume. I think that we're all busy consuming content and more that's like what we're kind of doing instead of, like you said, joining the DSA. I would point out about the DSA membership that since 1912, we have had the Red Scare and an ongoing like anti-communist panic that is unceasing and permeates all of society. So the people who are willing to be actual members is probably a much smaller amount, you know? For example, like I'm not technically a member. But...
Yeah. And we didn't keep membership lists for a good reason, because then the state would just run through that membership list.
Exactly.
And
they just qualified far left people and even trans people as like essentially like domestic terrorist groups. So we
fucking
the
Christ,
repression
bro.
Is real.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I would point that out. And then I would point out that the reason why I think like you or I or Hassan like have any power at all is because people are spending all their time consuming media. And that just means that I guess in like you were saying, we have the capacity to put in a pill into the peanut butter.
I see what you mean.
Do you know what I mean? Like, for example, Hassan will do whatever, like, entertaining streams, and then he'll spend part of the stream, like, supporting a candidate.
Right,
So undoubtedly out of guilt, because, like, again, we're all... I'm just joking about that, but undoubtedly, like, we're all, like, kind of creating content, and there comes a day where we go, well, could we do something?
Yeah. So I totally agree. And I see this enormous, enormous hazard, basically, where, sorry, I'm downloading onto you like a few conversations that we've had leading up to this. But the numbers are like 90% of all media is basically just like the peanut butter fluff. Like it has no impact. It doesn't mean anything.
Sure.
And then every now and then there's like a little thing. And so I think, you know, at the front of all of this is like, if I was in power tomorrow, I would just like turn the machine off. Like I just turn the social media machine off. But because I can't turn it off right now, what are the things that we can practically do with this? Is there a kind of minority, you know, scalpel approach at which it could work? And this is like the closest that I've been able to theorize up until this point. But I appreciate your patience with this.
No problem. I love talking about it. I mean, streaming is such a fascinating thing because streaming is about like length, right? So people will do it for like 8, 10, 12 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
It shows that right now, we don't just want to eat the peanut butter some of the time. We want like a peanut butter drip. We want 8 to 12 hours of this shit. And you're talking about attaching the little side bag.
I'll do the PB2 drip.
Maybe there'll
I'm
be a little
right
bit
now,
of like
so.
Nutrients. But it is true. We're craving more and more like that altered state, right? Like what happens when you go to bed after watching a stream for 8 to 12 hours?
Nightmares.
Yeah, and the reality is, are you better prepared for some sort of revolutionary movement? Are you about to go and organize more? No, people want to watch a stream more than they want to organize.
Yeah, there may be a version of this where certain forms of media are themselves in the aggregate counterproductive, that it is just psychologically and socially unhealthy.
I mean, streaming is psychologically and socially unhealthy from both sides, for the streamer and for the people watching it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't think anybody that streams would disagree with that, you know? It kind of ruins your life. And if you spend all your time watching streams, it also ruins your life. It gives you the kind of simulacra of action, of reality, while you're in fact sitting dully staring into the screen.
At the end of his career, Duchamp retired from art to just play chess.
Yeah.
And I think one day I will retire from content just to play World of Warcraft.
Nice. I think you might want to pick a better game, though. It's a little old.
It sucks now. It actually sucks. I can't go back.
Yeah.
Let me segue this into another.
Like, I am not above any of this. Like, I am a person who has addictive tendencies, who wants to feel numb, who wants to avoid everything. Mm. You know, I am that person. Like, that's why I know how it feels, is because I am that person. And the reason why I have the beliefs I have, or sometimes maybe I fight for something, is because, like, I am the first casualty of capitalism. Like, yeah. I want to go into stores. I want to buy the thing. I'm completely, my brain is designed to be manipulated by these systems, you know? And so that's why I'm quite combative, because I'm aware that at all times I exist in, like, the enemy territory that wants me to be, you know, drugged, numb, dissociated, or, like, in ecstasy in some way. Absent.
Let me segue us into some, I want to talk about some of your previous writing. You wrote a piece for Jacobin a while ago now, but it has one of my favorite headlines of all time, headers within the article, "The Men Who Stare at Posts." Extraordinary. To what degree has this Q lore just been absorbed into mainstream culture in the last few years?
Oh yeah, it's really in the water, is the way I put it. You know, I mean, QAnon, yeah,
literally in the water.
It literally is. Yeah,
it's the xenoestrogens.
Yes, exactly. It's the real PFAS. Okay.
The real, yeah.
Yeah, and it's making the frogs stupid. No, I'm joking, but yeah, no, it was. I mean, it's not a surprise to me. I mean, it's just Bircherism being reabsorbed into the system, like reformulated
John Birch society.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you for people who don't know what that is?
Bircherism was like a psychotically anti-communist organization that was like extremely paranoid and loved conspiracies. And so it's an ancient organization that still exists to this day, but it was a little more relevant, obviously, during like the Red Scare.
I didn't know they
stuff
were still
like
around.
That. They are.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's like suburban white people who were racist, but also economically libertarian and liked guns a lot.
I couldn't diagnose that. I'll leave that to you.
Okay.
But I think it is just, it's like, again, there's nothing new in QAnon. It's not brought anything new to the table. It's brought, you know, like blood libel, anti-communism, you know, satanic panic. And it's kind of synthesized it for a new generation, and just kind of course, a little bit like streaming is just like endless content. There's thousands of Q posts. It's also endless content. You can't consume the whole thing. You can't even see the whole thing from a single vantage point. You can only be in it. You can only be consuming it to understand it or to know it. You can only be inside it. But anyways, yeah, I think it was just like a natural process that was going to happen. It's like I said, it's just like a peach rotting, right? Like the rot arrived and we called it QAnon, and then the rot progressed, and before we knew it, it was the whole peach, and it was no longer called anything because it's no longer rotting, it's rotten. You know what I mean? So it's become a part of mainstream politics for everybody now. The way of thinking, wanting an insider that can give you the inside scoop, not trusting the official story on almost anything, doing your own research, you know, all these kind of tenets. Liberals are doing the exact same thing now.
It is funny how, liberals have kind of become, you know, the center has become the epicenter of conspiracy in some ways. What are your thoughts, like, post Epstein files release? Because I know you followed this in a much more granular fashion than I have. What has been like the impact onto American political consciousness? Did it seem to indirectly affirm those truths, or what has been the downstream result?
I mean, of course, QAnon people who've been yelling for a while about this, they're going to take this as a big win. The thing is, like, Epstein was around; they just didn't know about him or focus on him because he wasn't interesting. He didn't jive with their idea of a hidden world that is communicated through symbols mysteriously. Like, the man was just openly doing what he did. He was essentially convicted for what he did and, you know, given a sweetheart deal. He was doing it in plain sight. He wasn't even using code words often. So I think it's like a big win and lose for them, right? It shows that Epstein shows that we never needed like the QAnon bakers, the decoders, and all these guys. Huh. Like that we didn't get to what we know about Epstein because of them. Sorry, your technique just didn't work. Hmm. But that's because oftentimes the way that they read power structures is fundamentally fed by the system. Even though they think that they're finding like hidden truths in a system that they're like, I don't know, opposed to or awake about, or they know is evil and profoundly corrupt. The bottom line is most of their narrative relies on ancient tropes that reinforce power.
Yeah, yeah.
Like anti-communism, like the Red Scare, like, you know, like Satanic Panic.
What was Q wrong about that the Epstein files later revealed? Because I feel like we've had a few conversations that, you know, on a vibes level, the Pizzagate people were onto something because elite pedophilia is a real thing. They were factually incorrect.
That's it. They were directionally correct, I think.
Directionally, directionally. So what were they, if anything, what were they directionally wrong about?
Well, they don't understand power, right? They don't see capitalism as any kind, as playing any role. Mm. They do trust the market at the end of the day. That's why you find a lot of QAnon people, a lot of the figures that rose to the top were like, essentially like small business owners, there's surprisingly a lot of petty bourgeois participation in QAnon, you know? Mm. It's like your real estate agent or your local like jet ski dealer.
Middle class small business owner type?
Yeah, because what they're reading is, they're reading a system that they find unfair. They understand that the bourgeoisie is getting away with things that they're not, hey.
They know they're not Bezos.
What the hell, if I raped kids, I wouldn't be able to cover it up. Like, I would be busted on that. Like, what's the point of running my dealership and...
You sound mournful.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They are.
If only we could take advantage of those same privileges.
This is a country of, this is a deeply pedophilic country. Have you looked at the media?
Oh my God.
Yeah, everyone wants that privilege,
right? This
is
why I'm anti-free speech.
It's not that I would do it. I just want the privilege to be able to rape kids and cover it up. That's the petit bourgeois promise, man. One day you could ascend. Maybe one day you'd have access to those kids too. I mean, I'm joking, obviously, there's a certain amount of like, of wanting that privilege, right? They don't hate them because of what they have. They want what they have. Mm. And so they're diagnosing the system completely incorrectly. They don't understand where power lies because they don't understand the mechanism that set up power because they, at the end of the day, are the product of propaganda. Mm. Like QAnon is the ripening of years of like psychological operations, of like evangelical madness, you know, and like anti-communist panic, you know? Mm. So. I think it was always heading towards this.
What percentage of that type of conspiracy-minded view of the world is multiplied by the internet that is like unique compared to, I don't know how widespread the John Birch Society was, just the first thing that comes to mind because we were talking about it earlier, but like, was that 10% of society and now it's like closer to 50? You know, like how much of this is accounted for by the, you know, insane incentives of attention economy media and algorithms and all of this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I'd say it's the latter. I don't think that there's anything particularly unique about our period of time. Mm. I think like, if anything, we've been thrown distractions. You said it yourself, you would turn it off, right? You'd turn off social media.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be your first thing.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I'd probably do a dozen other things.
Okay.
But like,
but that's one of the big ones pretty quickly.
I think so. Yeah. I think so, it's basically becoming unsustainable where like there's some portion of society, like let's just say 10% of people are just wackadoos that we could never hope to convince, will always be counter-revolutionaries, will be like nuts. And so it's not worth trying to persuade them and whatever, but that percentage of society has just gotten bigger because we put them into this maddening echo chamber that just blasts them with nonsense all day. And so, I think we have to really get upstream of that in some way. And it's a profoundly uncomfortable topic. I've been talking about this with a few people over previous episodes, but it's like, I think the only language we have around this is like censorship because we are talking about constraints on media, you know? And it's pretty difficult to work our way through it.
Yeah, I see what you mean, of course, yeah. And of course, again, you'll never have access to that button. So it really, it's just us talking that it would affect, like, well, you saying that you would do something like that.
They've got access to the button now on, like, TikTok, right? Like,
sure, sure.
Yeah, so previously...
But do they, like, that would be a bit of a whack-a-mole, like, you whack down TikTok because you think it's too Chinese or something, and then...
So that was part of the pretense, but Wall Street Journal, God bless their soul, published just very explicitly about this, that whatever the lobbyist group that was trying to ban TikTok had a tremendous amount of uphill, you know, pushback from senators and people they were talking to in government right up until, you know, October 7th, at which point pro-Palestinian content outnumbered pro-Israel content at a ratio of 70 to 1.
Then the speech
and
became
so now,
an issue.
And so now, if you look at TikTok, it's like, oh, wait, I got zero views on that post? That's crazy.
Yeah.
So they have actually dialed the levers the other direction.
Same,
or turned the dials the other
this
direction.
This is true of almost every social media company, not just TikTok.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, essentially deeply affected by Zionist interests, you know, having like an editorial oversight board that like changes the algorithm to make sure that Zionist interests are represented. Mm. And that's why I think at the end of the day, it's a distraction. That's why you would turn it off, I think, you know, not because it's harmful. Of course it's poisonous, but it's just a distraction. So debating it is like, what kind of makes our era unique? Mm. What does make our era unique? In my opinion, a distraction. Mm. We have a big fucking distraction.
Yeah.
And we have to talk about it.
Okay, let's give some plugs for where people can find you. QAA podcast.
Absolutely.
Highly celebrated.
Thank you.
You guys are enormous. You're bigger than we could ever hope to be. Congratulations on your success. Superstructure, people can find on where? Apple, Spotify, what's your platform?
Yeah, they can find them on any of the platforms. The easiest way is just to go to superstructurepodcast.com. You can reach the free feed and you can reach the paid feed. You know, we have a pretty standard approach. It's $5 a month to get a second episode. You get one episode for free and one is behind the paywall every week.
Julian Field. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To watch part two of this episode, you can support the show on Patreon.